KBOO Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corelia, and my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
I have a very special guest in the studio today. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Kaya. I am the director at Street Roots.
I'm excited to actually have you in here. It's actually been one that I've actually wanted to for a while. There's so much going on right now in the city of Portland with the homeless situation. And the main one that is going on is the Portland Street Response that just actually got passed in city council.
Yeah, that's right. It's something a lot of people have been working on. I think of it as a groundswell, really. It's a situation where when we all look at the fact that people who are unhoused have way too large of criminal records just because they are out there in public spaces. And of course, that just makes life so much harder to get jobs or get housing.
Makes it almost a class issue. Mm-hmm. Makes them a different class citizen.
Right. And then that we look at it and think, you know, that's absurd. And if it's wrong, what do we have to do about it? And I think so many people in the city could just see, well, we should change the whole system.
Well, yeah. I mean, me and my co-host here actually went down to Eugene not too long ago, and we were looking at, like, what's going on there. And
they had some of those yurts going on. It was part of a program going through the site of St. Vincent de Paul, one of those churches that they had connected with the city, and these organizations
created some safe spaces or something.
These little huts and yurts and things like that. They look like the back of a covered wagon, sort of, like from the Oregon Trail, but without the wagon wheels.
You know, we didn't really get a chance to go see White Bird or Cahoots or any of that, but I know you went down there and a bunch of city officials did. And was it Emily Green that was the one that reported on the model first?
Yeah, Emily Green, senior Street Roots reporter, pulled together a plan, the Portland Street Response plan, for our March 15th issue. So she really dug in and just, you know, what would it take? Like, okay, how many vans would we need in Portland? What kind of budget would it be? And she interviewed the 911 folks, you know, it's the Bureau of Emergency Communications. One of the things that I found really interesting about that is that at any point during her interview, someone could have been like, yeah, it's a terrible idea. But it just feels like the right moment, because the head, his name's Bob Causey, he was like, yeah, it's great. We totally need to redo it. Yeah. We just kept finding that.
And so for our guests who haven't really been exposed to the model for Cahoots, what is it exactly that they do in there?
Yeah. So in Eugene, what the model is, and that's what it's based on, but it, of course, because of different conditions, it can't be replicated in the same way. Eugene has a really great history of having an organization called White Bird that's been around since the 60s. And but then it's been about 30 years that they've run Cahoots. And what that is a crisis worker and a medic, and they go out in teams, and they're sent out for non-criminal matters. They're actually on the same phone line as the police, so they get dispatched instead of the police, sometimes at the same time. So when I did my ride-along with them, you know, a number of different situations, you know, at one point it was just a woman calling because she found a needle in a flat, you know, and so sometimes it's just stopping and like being there for someone, because I was skeptical. I thought, my goodness, this doesn't seem like a great use of your time. But they said to me, no, actually, everyone has a story beneath the story. Like, for some reason, that really scared her. So we just show up. And another point, a man was having a kind of crisis. You know, he was really having an outburst by a convenience store. And when they arrived for him, he had a wound, so they tended to the wound. But he also was really upset because he couldn't get to a cancer treatment appointment. So they gave him a ride to that. And that's where I think of, you know, when people just kind of come in full on, think they know what someone needs, right? They would never find that out.
Yeah, just something as simple as a ride.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so stressful when you don't have the resources to take care of your own body. And that can, of course, put someone in crises. I mean, I think about that. I think about, you know, a man right now that I've seen him in outbursts in Old Town and spend a long enough time. And it might be that he's just really upset he hasn't seen his daughter in a long time. You know, there's just all these different reasons, of course, why we end up just acting out in public.
And the fact that they're unhoused in and of itself, I mean, right, just that factor is going to cause them to be stressed and be something that they're unhappy about because it isn't changed for
right.
them.
In their life, it's the, like, penultimate stressor.
It doesn't always have to be missing somebody. It doesn't always have to be a bad day or losing, you know, your mm-hmm. money. It's the fact that you're in the position you're in, and that's a genuine reason for many people to be unhappy and to have
that's
those
good
moments.
Point. That's a very good point. And you might be exhausted.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that the average person who's not been through that experience might forget to think about, that how tiring that is, like you said, exhausting to just go through those circumstances, and that every day, you know, what does that somebody have to go through just to do their daily needs?
Or thinking about, I mean, this gets...
They're not sure how to relate to that.
Yeah, like a different topic that you both were mentioning, but thinking about the fact that maybe you're trying to get your sleep by riding around on the 20 bus or something.
Oh, yeah,
in
yeah.
order to be able to get it. And, of course, dealing with harassment the whole time.
Yeah.
So
and think about the noise pollution in the city. We have train yards running through. Where can you go in this city? Where's some campground going to form that's not going to have to worry about vehicles passing by, people on the sidewalk going by, and trains and large, you know, whether it's planes from the airport or large trucks from all the industry coming through. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of noise pollution. There's a lot of light pollution. There's a lot of factors that are going to keep these people awake and stressed out.
The one that gets me, too, is these LED lights that have been put into the streetlights and the way that...
That may or may not have other surveillance
technology
in them.
I'm
not sure.
But, yeah, just the exposure to those LED lights, it's like the computer screen. Looking at the computer screen for several hours is very hard on your eyes. And these are our street lights now, as opposed to an incandescent bulb.
That is so interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. I mean, there's studies that show when you stare at a phone, you're not going to sleep as well. So that would make a lot of sense.
And I think that's attached to the whole Vision Zero movement by the city. And it's just like those lights are hard on most people's eyes.
Yeah, I hate bad lighting.
Right. It can actually affect, like you were saying, someone's psyche. I mean, on some people, it could cause headaches because they're... eyes and they just don't receive the light wavelengths the same way.
Right. Some of us are more sensitive than others to the same light.
And I mean, I'm not opposed to having like the lit up streets so that it's safe and everybody can see what's going on, but just not the LEDs. Those are hard on everybody. I mean, I even wonder what it's doing to like some of the animal life and stuff like that myself.
I want to know how solar they are. You know, to me, it seems like if we're upgrading things this day and age, they really need to be on the sustainable model. And what are we doing just putting in a different type of bulb if they aren't actually going to be the next generation of light?
Are they solar or are they not?
I don't think most of them are. There are some like artistic installations, things like that. Mm-hmm. There's a few downtown that are really fun looking. They got cool colors. And you see the solar panel on the top. And those panels are just to power that installation and the lights within it. But I think that kind of technology should be expanded for overall city infrastructures and national infrastructures. Like, we shouldn't be needing to use any electricity through former sources, through our currently wired system. We should be able to just use that purely off of solar. I think the bigger issue then comes to solar storage as well. So you've got areas that aren't as... solar efficient. There are different other sustainable technologies that are being developed to look into, but I still think it's the right step.
Yeah. And see, One area that actually comes to mind, too, about, like, the whole lighting and whatnot is up there in Lentz, where Portland State Response is going to be launching them. That neighborhood is historically known for not really having any paved streets throughout the back roads of it, bad lighting in several areas of it. One area that is in particularly bad in this city for the homeless encampments is actually 92nd Flavel, which is hopefully where most of the Portland Street Response will be responding to, is that area. Because that's one of the most heavily called, I guess, from the point in the, was it one point of contact?
That's so interesting. Yeah, so many phone calls just pour through that system.
Yeah, and coming from Lentz, and that's why when I was hearing that it was going to be Lentz, because, I mean, I came out of that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I was living on the streets there for a while. And that neighborhood really needs some help, but the whole city needs help in specific spots. There was actually a geography major thesis that was presented at PSU that kind of examined where the hot spots in town were, and it was along like the MAX and the bus lines, and mostly centralized in like Lentz and a few neighborhoods up in the what everybody's calling the numbers. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love actually to get your perspective. I mean, just to give a little context, I really felt like it was powerful, Corey, when you went out and surveyed to get information to then go into the planning for how this pilot could look. You went out and interviewed people in the very area where you were once homeless. Yeah. And then you encountered a sweep when you were doing that.
Yeah, that neighborhood's, I have a lot of history with that neighborhood. Most of the community that was around when I was homeless on the streets there have either passed away from multiple reasons. A lot of them were very old, so a lot of it was like natural causes and stuff like that. And I went back and started volunteering in the neighborhood with Clackamas Service Center and realized that the community was not the same, except for the fact that of how homey it was. Like, everybody was a family, but it was more of them, and it wasn't the same people. It was kind of like a mix. I'd say it's about a quarter left of the old people that were there when
so
I was on
the
streets.
So you knew some people still?
Yeah, I was on the streets there from 2010 to 2013. So I was very deeply entrenched in that neighborhood. I was living in a tent, living off the bike trail, and I was just like, I had no real support network. Mm-hmm. I myself fell into drug addiction not long after getting on the bike trail out there, and took a long time for me to get myself straight. Mm-hmm. After I got myself clean in 2013, went to school, sitting there, and it took me like 2 or 3 years to even really get out of the depression and stuff. It was really weird getting from being on the bike trail in a tent to being housed. And then when I was sitting there going through school and doing some research into what was going on and what was causing the homeless situation and the housing, the lack of mental health support, the lack of drug treatment, there's several things that are causing this. Mm-hmm. The stagnation of minimum wage. I started to realize, you know, it wasn't just me. It was this was happening to so many people, and it was happening in different ways to different people, the smallest little things. And so I was just like, yeah. When I went back there, and there was like 2 or 3 people that instantly recognized me whenever I go onto that strip of the bike trail that we went to. And so I figured that would be a good place to start, because it was meaning we'd have those people coming to us.
Yeah.
So it actually made it really easy to do the surveying and stuff, because everybody's like, oh, Corey. And I was like, okay, well, we're here for the survey for the Portland Street Response. And I was hoping you guys would be willing to talk to these people. And it was just very simple. But there's been a lot of sweeps along that stretch of the bike trail, because it parallels the 92nd Flavel MAX stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's technically a mix of like ODOT, PBOT, city property, and I don't even know who else, parks maybe even somewhere in there. And that whole stretch is very like contested who has jurisdiction on it. So it gets swept every like 48 hours. And when we showed up there to do the Portland Street Response, we just saw them doing the sweep down the way. And I was like, okay, guys, I don't know if we can do the surveying, but the people that were there were like, oh, hi, what are you guys doing? And wanted to talk. And it was just
While they were packing up? Yeah. Or, wow. And then do they tend to move a few blocks away and then come back? Or how does that?
So one of the ways I've been seeing it, because I've been going up there and kind of just keeping an eye on how the sweeps are being conducted on 92nd Flavel, a lot of them will sit there and they won't do sweeps on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So they'll only do them Monday through Thursday. And I've watched them on a Monday. I've watched them on a Wednesday in the white truck, sitting around the corner from the camp, waiting until people clear out and literally go down the line and be like, oh, well, nobody's here. Time to pack up all the stuff. Throw it in the back of the truck, not caring if it's anybody's personal belongings.
Wow.
And just packing it all up in their little dump truck and wheeling it out of there. And these people are usually going to get services at this time. Usually with that stretch of the bike trail, it's the Clackamas Service Center that they're heading to. And there's people that will just hang out there the entire time, won't even go get themselves services because they don't want to lose their stuff. When they get swept like that, if they have their things, I've seen them move only like 30 yards.
And I can imagine that somebody coming back from trying to deal with a job or get a service, use the bathroom, get food, just change their clothes, help a friend, anything. They come back, they find all their stuff done. They're probably going to have a bit of a breakdown, and that's kind of why I think you guys were looking at the Portland Street Response, is that so many people were being cycled back into having like criminal history records, tickets, and those sorts of things, just for having responses to their situation that are deemed socially unacceptable.
Yeah, I think the city picked that area in particular when they examined the 911 call rates, and it particularly high, but also then the geography was small enough that it wouldn't overwhelm a pilot team.
Yeah.
As opposed to maybe the Old Town neighborhood that would have a larger
geography. Yeah. The kind of concentration in Old Towns like here, there, lent its kind of along the max line. The bike trail.
What do you think the Portland Street Response Team needs to keep in mind going into that neighborhood?
Okay, so there are several individuals that I've seen over the years that kind of sit there and be a watchdog for the whole community. If somebody's in distress, they're the ones trying to help them out. And when they go into that neighborhood, it's probably key that they figure out which one of these people in that community is the one that they can just instantly be like, okay, what's going on here? Can you tell me what's been there, what happened in the situation? So in case this person that's in the distress can't even sit there and explain it to them, this person, there's several people in the community like that, and it's would just be easier from the tap into that.
So build the relations and understand the security that's already there.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to any homeless community, there's always somebody who's just kind of watching out for everybody else. And usually that's the person you want to talk to when it comes to interacting and whatnot with the Portland Street Response and whatnot. It would be really, really apt for them to tap into that. Just figure out who they need to talk to and just be like, okay, we're here. We're trying to respond to this. What's going on? So I think that's one thing. But I don't know. There's so many things going on up in Lentz and along that trail.
Why do you think that is?
Honestly, I don't know if the concentrations you see in the homeless situation right now downtown, North Portland, along that stretch of the bike trail, the peninsula crossing, and then the Springwater up in the east, and I don't know why the concentrations keep landing into that areas, really. Besides maybe the public transit, the access to it, because that ends up being the main way they can actually get around. Like you were saying earlier with the transit, the people riding on the bus is just to sit there and, you know, have some place to go. I've actually seen people riding buses from Gresham all the way to Beaverton just so they had some place to stay warm, especially out in, like, this weather that we're starting to head into.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
I remember not even, like, a week, 2 weeks ago, one of your benders ended up getting a ticket. And, I mean, with the new hop pass system with it,
what I read on the article was that he had gotten on a MAX train and he was wearing his pass around his neck with his vendor card and everything else like normal. And a fare inspector didn't believe the receipt that he had with his pass and didn't want to believe the veracity of a receipt saying that it's been paid for. So he chose to write the ticket anyway. And that just causes stress. And I think of like the time lost, the frustration gained. That's very unequal to somebody who's done everything right. Why can't these transit officers just believe someone, especially a vendor for Street Roots, which is well-known, you know, publication in Portland? Why wouldn't they believe the Street Roots vendor?
Just, you know, it was as simple as what? He forgot to tap
He forgot to tap. He, you know, he described how I think he was on the 20, the bus, and then he went to Street Roots. And so the time must have expired from when he first tapped, right? And then he ran to catch the Old Town Max and hopped on there and hadn't tapped. And he really, you know, he buys it as a monthly pass, so he wasn't even perceiving that he needed to necessarily tap or not tap. And one of the things that really struck me as I talked to him about it is he drew from this idea of, like, Les Miserables. He was drawing from the fact that, you know, that play is really based on this idea that the inspector gives no grace. He just goes with the letter of the law, whether you steal the loaf of bread because your family is hungry or other things. And
individual context doesn't seem relevant.
Exactly. That's beautifully put. And so, you know, Mark described that and he said, we just need more grace. We need to really, like, basically have our community thrive, not try to pull people down. And I'm, you know, he's worked through and had all these conversations now about that incident, he keeps going back to the idea of the community, which I think is really interesting. You know, he's like, this is maybe his situation was a catalyst. A lot of people are talking about it, but what do we need to think about as a community? And I think about that, like with Portland Street Response, you know, we could look as a community and say, okay, our system isn't working right. It's not, the police have a mission of enforcing the law. They should not be sent out when it's someone's in a mental health crisis. But then with the TriMet system, we have to also look at that, right? Like, I mean, my goodness, with climate justice, we want everyone to be riding the train and the bus. And
one thing that gets me with the Max right now too is they don't have a fare validator on board. And like, how are you supposed to if you forgot to tap on the way in?
I know. I've been having that lately, you know, because I'm sure most folks have not quite had the chance from time to time. And I just yesterday I was sprinting for a Max. I'm like, running to tap the card, sprint back.
I mean, I myself used to buy a monthly, and then like because every once in a while I wouldn't be paying attention to the date, and if it was like 30th, 31st, and rolled over to the 1st, I would keep an extra one of the paper tickets in my back pocket. And
that's smart.
And, like, if it was the middle of the month and I seen somebody hop on the bus that was like, oh, I don't have fare, I'd usually just pull that out and hand it to them and replace it, like, within the week or something. That way I had it for the first of the month. But I was used to the monthly pass where I didn't have to pull it out.
Right, and that's what Mark was used to. And, Leslie, you were talking about you have a student
pass. I have a student pass right now through my college where it's a sticker put on my college ID. It's not a TriMet card. It's not the hot pass. It's not really obvious. You have to know what it is. It's a tiny little sticker. And I flash it at a driver, and they just nod at me. Oh, uh-huh, sure. And I'm not sure if they've really seen it or not, but I do know I paid for it, so I'm going to go sit down. But with this whole situation coming up with new fare inspectors and people like your, you know, your vendor getting ticketed, that makes me wonder if I'm just waiting for a Max, I'm trying to do something for a few hours, that entire day could be gone just for having to deal with a fare inspector and prove that this is a real legitimate paid for type of fare, because I don't know if a fare inspector or TriMet officer is aware of the student passes or what they look like.
Because you need such context. And I mean, I'm thinking about too, the OPB report last week where they did the public records request.
Yes.
For the 2 months before the fare inspectors, and found only eight complaints out of, I can't remember how many, rides.
16 million,
yes.
I mean, that's astonishing. But then that most of these complaints were describing people as appearing, as presenting as homeless. And I mean, that just makes my stomach crawl, right? Because they were trying to do all this antagonism, dividing people, trying to incite, I would say, resentment.
In us versus them.
Yeah, it was mentality. Really horrible with their campaign where
yeah,
they had
the martini glass or something.
I was calling it the Let Them Eat Cake campaign.
See, that's classism again, because it says that this is the tier of people we're going to market to. This is the type of life we expect our writers to have. This is what we expect them to be able to afford, and their entertainments and their influences. And if you don't fall in this box, you're not really our kind of people.
Yeah.
And we're not really talking to you. So, I mean, that's kind of advertising and marketing works. You find a category and you try and tailor things to them. And it just became really obvious that this was class kind of based when they came out with that campaign, because it was so insensitive. It wasn't realistic to what people are really spending their money on. Why somebody would choose to go and have a $5 fast food meal that's technically eating out, but you don't have, you know, the money to go to the grocery store. You don't have 3 hours to cook. You don't have someone else. You have 20 minutes.
You can't cook in your camp because you can't deal with rats or whatever.
You don't have
leftovers.
A place to store food. Where are you going to prepare it? Where are you going to put it? Leftovers. There's so many questions going on. And that's just even people that are seriously low income. You've got all sorts of invisible houseless people that you have living in vehicles and living on people's couches that are staying in public places, community type places, whether they're colleges, libraries, or riding around the Max all night. They're finding ways to not be a tent homeless person, but they still have the same limitations. I mean, I see these people sitting around at businesses that are 24 hours as well.
And one thing I'd love to add to that part, too, Leslie, is that, like, with the public spaces, those are even disappearing daily, basically.
Right. If someone was to sit at a camp, you know, a park, and camp out there in their vehicle and read a book, are they going to get called on?
Right.
Are they going to have police check on them? Or is their vehicle going to get reported, their license plate tracked somewhere, and they might not never find out that they've been reported on by that neighbor?
When you were describing all the ways that people aren't obviously homeless, it makes me really appreciate that report that Marisa Zapata did with PSU that showed, I think she estimated 38,000 for the metro region, because she said, you know, we need to throw the net out wider in terms of who we're talking about.
And when
homeless.
We interviewed her, she said
you did. So you guys are amazing.
I believe she was our podcast episode number 6. And then we had Dr. Greg Townley in as well.
Number 8, was he?
It was after Marisa.
Yeah.
But we had them both in and each share a lot about the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative.
Yeah.
And they're doing a lot of amazing work, I think, exposing the breadth and width of the problem here in this city.
And the survey that Corey worked on with us is a collaboration with them.
Yeah.
Right.
Because we want to, and I'm really pleased that we want to really promote the fact that people who have experienced homelessness or who are currently homeless should be able to be a part of the research. Because sometimes, just like you were describing, more people talk to you on that trail than, you know, if like I'd gone to the same place. So I really appreciate that they're embracing that idea of the community research. And with
I think I overwhelmed, because when I went, I had Greg with me.
Okay.
One of your vendors, I can't remember his name at the moment. I friended him on Facebook, though. I'll have to look it back. But
he's been very busy.
And then Maggie Vespa from
KGW.
I think I had quite
a day.
I think I overwhelmed Greg and Maggie with how many people were just coming towards us when we showed up there, because I was there. I was just like, hi, guys.
Probably showed them the importance of really thinking about how we do community research, and that now with Portland Street Response, it's built in that there'll be parallel evaluation using that same structure.
So for someone who, this might be the first time that they're trying to learn about the Portland Street Response.
Yeah.
Sorry. The Portland Street Response.
Yeah.
How does that work real quickly? Just break it down for them.
Thank you. Yes. So the Portland Street Response right now will be comprised of a medic and a crisis worker. And the crisis worker has not been hired. The medic is going to be Tremaine Clayton, who is an emergency medical specialist with Portland Fire and Rescue. He runs their chat program at this at this time, which is for frequent 911 callers. And he became really interested, or not interested, but he was moved by the fact that the emergency is often homelessness. So they had to rethink what they were describing as an emergency with Portland Fire and Rescue. He also volunteers in his free time with Whitebird in Eugene and Kahoot. So he was sort of tailor-made to put a lot of energy behind this. The pilot is then just one van, two people, Lentz neighborhood, and it's slated to start in spring of 2020. Right now, it's already commenced, so it's just between now and then there needs to be the training, hopefully with Whitebird, with Cahoots coming up and doing that.
What kind of training is going to be involved? Are there things like sensitivity training for the officers, dealing with trauma-informed interaction?
I think we have to keep pushing to make sure there's really good training. I think it always comes back to the community with all this. But yes, my understanding with Whitebird is they do pretty extensive training. And it's the sensitivity, the de-escalation skills, the active listening, all of that. And there's also, of course, just the medical in terms of doing the what they call like low acuity medical situations, so the wound care and things like that.
I got invited to, I think it was the first one that they were doing here in town.
Right, in September?
Yes.
How did that go? I wanted to go to that.
It was quite interesting. I think it was Benjamin. Is the one that was hosting it, and he was talking about something like 500 hours of training just to get certified for them.
Which I love. Like, that's something that I really want to push on with Portland Street Responses. There is extensive training. You know, the thing that's different in Portland for this pilot versus Eugene is that we didn't have that same Whitebird clinic. It's going to be under Portland Fire and Rescue. So the key is they can't come out as fire people. It's got to be using the infrastructure of fire, but with hoodies or whatever.
The more like health people, workers.
Yes. Health workers.
I heard you guys were like looking for suggestions or whatnot for the uniform. I suggest tie-dye. No.
Tie-dye, right, but I mean some joy or something
comfortable, something disarming, and something that says that you can relax.
Right.
You know, this doesn't have to be so rigid.
Right. There's no badge. There isn't this tight uniform. There's no lights that are going to set off
seizures.
That's
very interesting because it says that they're taking a very very realistic psychological approach, saying, like, what are the factors that make people set up walls? And someone being in uniform is definitely triggering for people that have been through trauma or been through, you know, multiple abuses of the system.
And that is something that came out through the survey we did, which was called Believe Our Stories and Listen, because that's one of the things that someone said. And to me, that's at the heart of training, right? Is how do people actually believe the stories of the people that they're talking to and listen to them? And how do they not just impose their will on that person? So, because to me, it's very important that they don't just come out thinking they're going to connect people to services, but that they actually listen to what that person wants.
Those officers in the van with the pilot that's going to be going on.
They'll have like granola bars and water and all of those things. Hopefully naloxone, of course. And
how are they going to like collect all that data? Do they like make a report at the end of their shift? Do they have cameras, body cameras on? How are they collecting the data from
Ride along, maybe? I don't know.
How are they collecting the data from that pilot program?
Well, I know they're going to bring iPads, so I'm not sure how they're planning on doing that in terms of the simultaneous collection. But I do know that Greg Townley is going to be working with them to be evaluating side by side, or not necessarily him with them, but so that there can be adjustments the whole time too. Because I think one of the questions is, how do people with lived experience get involved? How is the peer model used? There's the whole kind of professional, like peer support specialist. Do they have a role in this? I think these are all things that need to be figured out. So then the pilot has about a year. And then what I think is we're in a quieter part of the campaign, but as we as a community keep watching this pilot, keep pushing, making sure it's going in the right direction, and then push like hell to get a really big budget for it. Because if it's set up with a too small of a budget, it's going to fail because people won't get
They'll be overwhelmed by with need and without the ability to service the need, right? Which could exacerbate issues.
Right.
And people could escalate saying, why not help me?
Right. And it's going to be a lot less expensive than sending police out. So it's not going to be, you know, a demand on the budget in that way. It's just a matter of reallocating what the resources are. So, yeah, I mean, I think about this all in terms of campaign, right? Like once we've had the plan out, how did people motivate this to get to this point? And now we can feel satisfaction that the city has embraced this, but how do we make sure it's done well? How do we make sure it's nimble so that, you know, I think about like at Street Roots, we sometimes have crises that we have trouble getting the right people to support us with, and we have to de-escalate a lot of the crises ourselves. And luckily, you know, most we get trained and we have a lot, you know, a fair amount of experience, and that's not the case in every situation.
One I'd love to actually highlight here was I think it was the August 17th rally downtown that ended up going right in front of your office.
It did, yeah.
And I mean, that in itself is usually scary for like a lot of businesses and stuff, because it's just suddenly this huge, massive crowd, police, violence going on right in front of them. But one thing that I've always like wondered and kind of like thought about too is the homeless downtown when these rallies are going on, and like they're just wherever they're at, and suddenly it just descends on them in the middle of the street.
Yeah. I mean, I was so struck by that with that rally, because we actually had a street fair planned for that time, but we moved it to the next day. It seemed like we would have a hard time having people want to turn out in the streets like that. But we realized at the same time, of course, everyone who's homeless, who's out there is out there. So we kept our office open all day beyond when we usually do, had a potluck, did a lot of different things just to kind of keep morale. Of course, people were really agitated, and it was a really challenging day. But exactly that, Corey. I mean, they're out there anyway, and they're just in harm's way.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to worry about the unhoused coming in to Sturt Roots before seeking safety during any of these rallies, or is that really a first?
Well, you know, I've only been there 2 years, but that when I think about in terms of a rally, that is the main one that has stood out for me. I mean, they ended up, what's his face? The main
Gibson.
Thank you. Yeah. The guy with the American flag. He came marching down, shouting, trying to drum up a lot of attention. And then someone tried to drown him out by revving her motorcycle. And of course, she's the one who ended up.
I saw an article about that.
Yeah. And so and some of our vendors came out and started yelling at Joey Gibson. And we were like, you know, not wanting life to get harder. That's what I always, to me in those situations, it's just like, you know who's going to actually get targeted in a moment like that. So if someone who's unhoused is going to be in much more of a difficult position than someone who's presenting as housed. So it makes me scared for them, is that they're going to somehow just get pulled in and arrested or something just because they start, you know, yelling rightly at Joey Gibson.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that if I remember correctly, that one started right there at the waterfront park. There's a lot of people that usually camp under along those bridges right there. And there was massive crowds that were going along waterfront that day. I can only imagine if these people didn't know what was going on, if somebody was asleep and all of a sudden there's cops right next to you and a bullhorn screaming.
Well, the whole Old Town area has been known for being a spot where houses can go and congregate. Mm-hmm. It's been like that for years because we've had the mission down there and other services. So they're going to come down there to access services.
And it, you know, when I think about with Portland Street Response, I think about that weekend and, there's a lot of fallout from that weekend. I can think of several people where actually the stress of that then led to something else that led to something else. You know, like there's big costs to moments like that.
I feel it. I mean, and I love that you guys are actually having a potluck for them too. I mean, food can actually help relieve a lot of these stresses. That's actually kind of jumps into my next topic I wanted to talk to you about. The meals up there at Director's Park.
Yeah.
And Commissioner Fish's new ordinance, or an ordinance he's trying to push hard on to try and keep meals from free hot soup from serving meals up there in Director's Park.
Yeah, I think so. It's been really interesting because I haven't been able to see the like an original text, and I haven't found anyone who has except for the flyer that's been, you know, that parks people have been passing out, and everything sort of word of mouth is, well, they're not really going to enforce it yet. But the thing is there's a real chilling effect when everyone doesn't know what's going on and there's sort of the threat of enforcement. And I just feel like, I mean, again, thinking about things being really absurd, people, you know, who are homeless and jumping through all these systems, getting on wait lists for shelters, waiting years to get on a wait list to get a Section 8 voucher, you know, trying to manage medical appointments, not getting their sleep, all of the different hurdles and barriers that are going on. You know, maybe someone's dealing with an opiate addiction and they have to wait, you know, do the methadone like clinic that day, and then they have to get to it. I mean, there's just a million things people are juggling. And
timing
I,
out using the bathroom.
Yes. I am so impressed.
Being
by
able to use the bathroom like twice a day, and they've
right.
got to like bend their whole day around that, especially
yeah.
if they're taking the MAX or public transportation. They have to know what bus stops they can do. And then if they have certain errands, they would have to organize that based on it's very complex.
It's
I mean,
very
the amount
complex.
Of energy.
Yes.
If you sit down and talk to someone, what they're going through, mental gymnastics,
yeah.
it's mind-blowing. And you just think, wow, the average house person just gets to wake up and, you know, you can leave your bed a mess if you really want. And you can just throw on the clothes that are right there and you just out the door. I mean, you can just be on with
you
your day.
You leave your bed a mess and someone's not logging into one point of contact to report you.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah. You don't.
You can walk around without pants without anybody
you
reporting you.
You can drink your glass of Chardonnay
after
right?
work, right before you go to bed. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So then if there's extra barriers with sharing food in the park, say that one of the things they're talking about in addition to the insurance and all of that is that food could only be served once a week rather than the 5 days that free hot soup is served. Well, that just drives me crazy because I'm like, why are you making it harder to help? If people want to be helpful, if they want to pitch in, if neighbors want to support other neighbors, why on earth in our city would we make it more difficult?
Well, of course, it's if you want to serve more days, you have to get the special permit, and that just costs just a little bit more.
Yeah.
For just a little bit more money, you could serve your soup for extra days, and for the special fancy price, you could pick any day of the week, and we'll call you a good donor.
Exactly.
I mean,
instead of just
like
pitching in. And
that's
saying,
what I see
yeah.
personally. I mean, personally, when you yeah. ask those questions, my first thought is capitalism and who's yeah. going to get their piece of the pie and how dare you give pie to other people that don't carry pie boxes and refrigerators.
That
know?
Is beautifully put, Leslie.
One of the things I've been looking at in this whole situation, too, is like what's happened across the nation with these previous situations that kind of shadow this. There's like mm-hmm. Fort Lauderdale's with Food Not Bombs. They fought the city.
They won.
They
That's
won, and it was pretty much declared in District 11 that it is protected under mm-hmm. the First Amendment, I think it was?
Yes.
As a political act of expression.
You are allowed to give your food to somebody else, period. You're allowed to give your food to somebody else.
Yes. Picnicking and, is not a problem. Yeah.
Right. I mean, if I didn't want to finish my sandwich, here you go.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
yeah.
not illegal.
Yeah.
And it never should be. It is irrational to think that
right.
someone believes it could be.
Right.
And see, I myself have been following the thing that's been going on with free hot soup. I went mm-hmm. down there, did an interviews, and then I also did like a small documentary with them.
Fantastic.
And I've been talking to them since further. And they're even talking about, you know, they had cops come to their Wednesday service, and they were trying to talk to them about, hey, you know, all this new ordinance, and then they apparently got the cops to actually eat some of the food, so.
Kindness really can go a long way sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think just like with, you know, TriMet being really unsavvy, doing a PR campaign that ignited a lot of rage in many of us, and that issue is not going to go away for them. I think it's the same thing with this situation. I mean, you know, we have plenty of people who are lawyers who will
back this up.
Yeah,
they're pretty much looking at these kind of situations yeah. and they're like, hey, city's going a little too far.
Yeah. So these are, it's just been a really interesting week, hasn't
yeah.
it? that there's the
yeah, definitely been a weird week.
I myself was kind of upset I wasn't able to make the Portland Street Response thing at City Hall on Wednesday. I had class, so.
Well, that's, I mean, class should always prevail. I'm pro education.
Well, we're both busy students, but we're at different colleges. Yeah. So I wanted to thank you, Kaya, for coming in.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. You guys are fabulous, and I love that you're doing this podcast.
Thank you. Yeah. Would you leave some information for the listeners as to where can they go to read up on street roots, find out more about you?
Definitely.
And connect with you on social media.
I would love that. Well, my Twitter handle is mkayasand, but our Street Roots Twitter handle is Street Roots, and then Facebook, Instagram, so you always can keep up with us through that. Find our vendors, though, all over the city, and please buy Street Roots for them. They actually are running their own business, buying each paper for a quarter and selling it for $1, so tip them mightily. And it's a really great way also just to get to know folks. And
yeah, good luck with the Portland Street Response. I hope
thank you.
All goes well.
Well, thank you. And we're all in it together. There's a lot of fights that we have ahead, aren't there?
We're looking forward to reading about them in the next Street Roots issue.
Okay.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Thank you.
KBOO Portland.